This is The Poet and the Poem. I'm Grace Cavalieri. In 1996, the Goethe Institute of Washington, D.C. sponsored a poetry exchange with four German poets reading at the Library of Congress. Four American poetry colleagues were invited to the German capital, where we were guests of the Literatische Colloquium Berlin. The four invited poets were Rita Dove, Henry Taylor, Roland Flint, and Grace Cavalieri. I'm happy to present two of these readings from Berlin. Pulitzer Prize winners, Rita Dove and Henry Taylor. First, we will hear Rita Dove, former poet laureate of the United States, the recipient of the National Humanities Medal and the Heinz Award, among many other honors. Here is Rita Dove, live in Berlin. I'm Grace Cavalieri.
It's wonderful to be back in Berlin, though Berlin has changed and is changing every second, particularly to be here at the Literarische Colloquium, this beautiful building, which I hope will stay here housing writers and translators and scholars for as long and even longer than Berlin stands. I'd like to start with a poem that's just a few years old and is not yet in a book of poems. It's in a book of essays, because I think in a way it links a little bit the spirit of Washington, D.C., where I was for 2 years as poet laureate, and also the spirit that's now happening to Berlin as Berlin becomes a true capital city and is going through lots of growing pains. When I became poet laureate and moved into my office at the Library of Congress, which is directly across the street from the Capitol building, I looked out the window and saw that the Statue of Freedom, which normally was on top of the dome of the Capitol building, had been taken down for repairs and was in the parking lot of the Capitol. And I thought this was wonderful. What a symbol that freedom needed to be cleaned up. And I looked at her, and I really felt a kinship with her. And I thought, you know, she is homeless at this moment. And she was slightly embarrassing because she was dirty and she was out of place and people didn't know what to do with her, either ignore her or take photos of her. And so I wrote a poem that was about the homeless in Washington, D.C., but also about those kinds of refurbishings that we have to do occasionally to our ideals, to our whole idea of what a city, what freedom is. So this poem is for her and for us, and it's called Lady Freedom Among Us. Don't lower your eyes or stare straight ahead to where you think you ought to be going. Don't mutter, "Oh no, not another one. Get a job, fly a kite, go bury a bone." With her old-fashioned sandals, with her leaden skirts, with her stained cheeks and whiskers and heaped-up trinkets, she has risen among us in blunt reproach. She has fitted her hair under a hand-me-down cap and spruced it up with feathers and stars. Slung over one shoulder, she bears the rainbowed layers of charity and murmurs, "All of you, even the least of you. Don't cross to the other side of the square. Don't think another item to fit on a tourist's agenda. Consider her drenched gaze, her shining brow. She who has brought mercy back into the streets and will not retire politely to the potter's field. Having assumed the thick skin of this town, its gritted exhaust, its sun scorch and blear, she rests in her weathered plumage, big-boned, resolute. Don't think you can ever forget her. Don't even try. She's not going to budge. No choice but to grant her space, crown her with sky, for she is one of the many, and she is each of us." People have asked me what the obligations of a poet laureate are, and they're very vague. But one of the things that a laureate does not have to do is to write poems for public occasions. However, I was asked if I wanted to say a few words when Lady Freedom was put back into place. And I read this poem thinking that, with a great satisfaction, that many of the politicians who were giving speeches wouldn't understand it until much later. Just a few days ago, actually this weekend, there was a translator's forum, a workshop here at the Literarische Colloquium, and I've had the real privilege of being translated into German and being able to understand the translations and feeling really very honored to have had that work done. I'd like to then, in honor of that workshop and in honor of the translators, one of whom is here today, Karin Graf, I'd like to read two poems in both in English and in German. And I think I'll start with the English, which you have, and then I will try to read the German, do it justice. The first poem is a poem called, it's really about translation, but then everything we do is translation, I think. The name of the poem is the Swedish word for island. It is a beautiful word, a single O with an umlaut above it. And so the poem is called Ö. Shape the lips to an O, say A. That's island. One word of Swedish has changed the whole neighborhood. When I look up, the yellow house on the corner is a galleon stranded in flowers. Around it, the wind. Even the high roar of a leaf mulcher could be the horn blast from a ship as it skirts the misted shoals. We don't need much more to keep things going. Families complete themselves and refuse to budge from the present. The present extends its glass forehead to sea, backyard breezes, scattered cardinals. And if, one evening, the house on the corner took off over the marshland, neither I nor my neighbor would be amazed. Sometimes a word is found so right, it trembles at the slightest explanation. You start out with one thing, end up with another, and nothing's like it used to be, not even the future. This little book was printed by Heiderhof Verlag. It's called Die Gläserne Stirn der Gegenwart, so the glass forehead of the present, taken from this poem and translated by my husband, Fred Fieban. That's a tricky thing to be translated by your husband. Spitz die Lippen zum O, sagt E. Das heißt Insel. Ein Wort Schwedisch hat die ganze Gegend verwandelt. Wenn ich aufblicke, ist das gelbe Haus an der Ecke eine zwischen Blumen gestrandete Galeone. Um es der Wind. Sogar das schrille Röhren eines Laubsaugers könnte das Getute eines Dampfers sein, wie er die nebligen Klippe umschifft. Vielmehr braucht's nicht, alles im Schwung zu halten. Familien vervollständigen sich und weigern sich, von der Gegenwart abzuweichen. Die Gegenwart bietet dem Meer ihre gläserne Stirn, Gartenbrisen, vereinzelte Kardinale. Und wenn eines Abends das Haus an der Ecke über der Marsch abheben würde, während weder ich noch mein Nachbar darob verwundert. Manchmal findet sich ein Wort so treffend, es erzittert bei der kleinsten Erklärung. Man fängt mit der einen Sache an, gerät an eine andere. Und nichts bleibt, wie es einst war, nicht mal die Zukunft. I'm going to read you only one poem from Thomas and Beulah, because it is the story loosely told of my grandparents, and I either have to read one or 20, and I think I will spare you 20, so I will just read one. This is the first poem in the second section of the book. Beulah is a child in this poem, and the book is divided into two sections. The first section is the husband's point of view, the second section is the wife's point of view. She's a girl in this poem, a very young girl trying to understand the logistics of her family, and her mother is doing something which many black women have done to make a living. she takes in laundry of other people. The poem is called Taking in Wash. Papa called her Pearl when he came home drunk, swaying as if the wind touched only him. Towards winter, his skin paled, buckeye to ginger root, cold drawing the yellow out. The Cherokee in him, Mama said. Mama never changed. When the dog crawled under the stove and the back gate slammed, Mama hid the laundry. She barked as she barked in snow or clover, a spoiled and ornery bitch. She was Papa's girl, black though she was. Once, in winter, she walked through a dream all the way down the stairs to stop at the mirror, a beast with stricken eyes who screamed the house awake. Tonight, every light hums, the kitchen arctic with sheets. Papa is making the hankies sail. Her foot upon a silk-stitched rose, she waits until he turns, his smile sliding all over. Mama, a tight dark fist. Touch that child, and I'll cut you down, just like the cedar of Lebanon. I've never been able to do anything in any organized fashion, so I know that I skipped a poem. I'll go back to it, but I wanted to do the translations in one group. This poem was translated as the entire book, Die Morgenländische Tänzerin, from Karin Graf, beautifully translated. Wäsche annehmen. Papa nannte sie Pearl, wenn nach Hause kam, betrunken und schwankend, als fasse der Wind nur ihn. Gegen Winter bleichte seine Haut Rosskastanien bis Ingwerfarben, die Kälte zog das Gelb heraus. Der Cherokee in ihm, sagte Mama. Mama blieb immer die gleiche. Wenn der Hund unter den Ofen kroch und das Hoftor schlug, versteckte Mama die Wäsche. Schieber bellte wie sonst bei Schnee oder Klee, ein verwöhnter und verstockter Hund. Sie war Papas Mädchen, schwarz wie sie war. Einmal im Winter ging sie im Traum die ganze Treppe hinab und blieb vor dem Spiegel stehen, ein Tier mit weit wunden Augen, das das Haus wach schrie. Heute Abend summt jede Lampe, die Küche einer Arktis, lauter Lacken, und Papa lässt die Taschentücher segeln. Den Fuß auf eine Rose, seidengestickt, wartet sie, bis er sie sich umdreht, sein Lächeln vorüberzieht. Mama, ein geballte, dunkle Faust. Rühr das Kind an und ich hau dich um wie die Zedern des Lebanon. This poem is based on an actual occurrence. It happened in 1957 in the Dominican Republic. At that time, the dictator Rafael Trujillo had ordered approximately 20,000 Dominicans executed. He distinguished Dominicans from the Haitians. They worked side by side in the cane fields. He could only distinguish them because they spoke a Spanish, when they spoke Spanish. They originally had a Creole, a French. They could not roll their R's, as you do in Spanish. So instead of having words like Catarina, it would come out as an L, like Catalina. And so he chose a word with an R in it, a Spanish word, and had each cane worker pronounce this word. It was the word for parsley. And those who rolled their R's lived, and those who didn't died. In fact, I came across mention of this historical event in a German book called Petersilie by Walter Dietrich Schnurren, and tracked down the occurrence. The poem is in two parts, and I'll read, each part has a title as well. It's called Parsley. The Cane Fields. There is a parrot imitating spring in the palace, its feathers parsley green. Out of the swamp, the cane appears to haunt us, and we cut it down. El General searches for a word. He is all the world there is. Like a parrot imitating spring, we lie down screaming as rain punches through, and we come up green. We cannot speak an R, Out of the swamp, the cane appears, and then the mountain we call in whispers, Catalina. The children gnaw their teeth to arrowheads. There is a parrot imitating spring. El General has found his word, Perejil. Who says it lives. He laughs, teeth shining out of the swamp. The cane appears in our dreams, lashed by wind and streaming. And we lie down. For every drop of blood, there is a parrot imitating spring. Out of the swamp, the cane appears. The Palace. The word the general's chosen is parsley. It is fall when thoughts turn to love and death. The general thinks of his mother, how she died in the fall, and he planted her walking cane at the grave, and it flowered, each spring stolidly forming four-star blossoms. The general pulls on his boots. He stomps to her room in the palace, the one without curtains, the one with a parrot in a brass ring. As he paces, he wonders, who can I kill today? And for a moment, the little knot of screams is still. The parrot, who has traveled all the way from Australia in an ivory cage, is coy as a widow, practicing spring. Ever since the morning, his mother collapsed in the kitchen while baking skull-shaped candies for the Day of the Dead, the general has hated sweets. He orders pastries brought up for the bird. They arrive dusted with sugar on a bed of lace. The knot in his throat starts to twitch. He sees his boots the first day in battle, splashed with mud and urine, as a soldier falls at his feet, amazed. How stupid he looked at the sound of artillery. I never thought it would sing, the soldier said, and died. Now the general sees the fields of sugar cane lashed by rain and streaming. He sees his mother's smile, the teeth gnawed to arrowheads. He hears the Haitians sing without R's as they swing the great machetes. Catalina, they sing, Catalina, mi madre, mi amor en muerte. God knows his mother was no stupid woman. She could roll an R like a queen. Even a parrot can roll an R. In the bare room, the bright feathers arch in a parody of greenery as the last pale crumbs disappear under the blackened tongue. Someone calls out his name in a voice so like his mother's, a startled tear splashes the tip of his right boot. My mother, my love in death. The general remembers the tiny green sprigs men of his village wore in their capes to honor the birth of a son. He will order many, this time, to be killed for a single beautiful word. One more out of this book before I go to Grace Notes. I realized when coming here how intimately interwoven Berlin is, actually, with my life. I've been here quite a few times, and this poem was inspired by an exhibition that I saw here in Berlin. It was a retrospective on Christian Schad, the painter from the Neue Sachlichkeit, from the New Austerity. It's a very startling double portrait of a man who is deformed and a woman who is black, and it's called Augusta der Flügelmenschen, Rasche die schwarze Taube. I think the only thing odd about her was the fact that she was black in 1929 in Berlin. They both appeared in sideshows here in Berlin as a couple for maximum effect. And Shaw did a very wise thing. He positioned them in a very classical pose, as if there was nothing at all odd about them, and he has them staring out at you so that you begin to feel like the freak. Augusta, the winged man, and Rasha, the black dove. Shad paced the length of his studio and stopped at the wall, staring at a blank space. Behind him, the clang and hum of Hardenbergstrasse, its automobiles and organ grinders. 4:45. His eyes traveled to the plaster scrollwork on the ceiling. Did that hold back heaven? He could not leave his skin. Once he'd painted himself in a new one, silk green, worn like a shirt. He thought of Rasha, so far from Madagascar, turning slowly in place as the boa constrictor coiled counterwise its heavy love. How the spectators gawked, exhaling beer and sour herring sighs. When the tent lights dimmed, Rasha went back to her trailer and plucked a chicken for dinner. The canvas, not his eye, was merciless. He remembered Katya, the Russian aristocrat, late for every sitting, still fleeing the October Revolution, how she clutched her sides and said not one word. Whereas Augusta, the doorbell rang, was always on time, lip curled as he spoke in wonder of women trailing backstage to offer him the consummate bloom of their lust. Shad would place him on a throne, a white sheet tucked over his loins, the black suit jacket thrown off like a cloak. Augusta had told him of the medicine of the medical students at the Charité, that chill arena where he perched on a cot, his torso exposed, its crests and fins a colony of birds trying to get out, and the students, lumps caught in their throats, taking notes. Ah, Rasha's foot on the stair. She moved slowly, as if she carried the snake around her body always. Once she brought fresh eggs into the studio, flecked and warm as breath. Augusta in classical drapery then, and Rasha at his feet, without passion. Not the canvas, but their gaze, so calm, was merciless. These two are really companion poems. The first one is called Canary. A canary is not only the bird in the cage, it's not only the bird that miners take down into the mines to test for poison gas leaks if the bird dies and they know the mine isn't safe for men, but it's also a term that jazz musicians use for the female vocalist. So this is kind of interesting, isn't it? Canary. Billie Holiday's burned voice had as many shadows as lights. A mournful candelabra against a sleek piano, the gardenia her signature under that ruined face. Now you're cooking, drummer to bass, magic spoon, magic needle. Take all day if you have to with your mirror and your bracelet of song. Fact is, the invention of women under siege has been to sharpen love in the service of myth. If you can't be free, be a mystery. And this is dedicated to all of the wonderful women from the islands who, from Guadeloupe, Martinique, Réunion, who walk the streets of Paris as if they own them. They are pretty remarkable. The island women of Paris skim from curb to curb like regatta. From Pont-Neuf to the Quai de la Rappe in cool negotiation with traffic, each a country to herself transposed to this city by a fluke called imperial courtesy. The island women glide past, held aloft by a wire running straight to heaven. Who can ignore their ornamental bearing, turbans haughty as parrots, or deft braids carved into airy cages transfixed on their manifest brows? The island women move through Paris as if they had just finished inventing their destinations. It's better not to get in their way, and better not look an island woman in the eye, unless you like feeling unnecessary. I'd like to read a more recent poem, Incarnation in Phoenix. Into this paradise of pain, she strides on the slim tether of a nurse's bell, her charcoal limbs emerging from crisp whites, unlikely as an envelope issuing smoke. I've rung because my breasts have risen, artesian. I'm not ready for this motherhood stuff. Her name is Raven, and she swoops across the tiled wilderness, hair boiling thunder over the rampart of bobby pins spoking her immaculate cap. She dips once for the baby just waking, fists punching in for work right on schedule, bends again to investigate what should be natural, milk sighing into one tiny vociferous mouth. Ah, she whispers, ambrosia, shaming me instantly. But no nectar trickles forth, no manna descends from the vault of heaven to feed this pearly syllable, this package of leafy persuasion dropped on our doorstep and ripening before us, a miniature United Nations, just like me, Raven says, citing the name of her mother's village somewhere in Norway, her father a buffalo soldier. Now, of course, we can place her. An African Valkyrie who takes my breast in her fists, grunting, "This hurts you more than it does me." Then my laugh squeezed to a whimper and the milk running out. Thank you.
We have just heard Rita Dove reading her poetry at the Literati Colloquium in Germany, guest of the Goethe Institute, Washington, D.C. Next, we will hear Henry Taylor. I'm introducing him live in Berlin. I'm Grace Cavalieri.
I am very happy to be a stand-in introducer for Henry because I have known him 69, 79, 89 more than 20 years. When I moved to Washington, his first book was just coming out, and I knew the book before I knew Henry, so that was very, very nice. And I've been following with my hand on his pulse for a long time. We would be up late, very, very late at night if we put in all of his credits. But he was born in Virginia, received his undergraduate degree from the University of Virginia and his graduate degree from Hollins College. And he is now a professor at American University in Washington, D.C. He's received many, many awards and fellowships as very, very honored ones, such as the Witter Binner Prize for Poetry and, of course, the Pulitzer Prize for Poetry. And that was in 1984. No, that was in 1986. And it was on Jeopardy one night. Who won the Pulitzer for 1986? Henry Taylor. He has read throughout the United States and has published numerous books. His brand new book is on the table. It is called Understanding Fiction, and it is from LSU. I have known him to be working, teaching, developing ideas to teach writing by way of computer in the early 80s, before any of us even owned one. I knew him when he was translating Greek tragedies and is now doing another one. And I think that is still in print, your first one, right, Henry? I have known him to do formidable, austere, and scholarly things, and then show up at a poetry slam and win. He is all over the place in poetry. I have known him when he was a film critic for the Cannes Film Festival, which is a little-known thing. He has read all over the world, and he writes book reviews for the Washington Times. And I wish to say that last year I read his new book of essays. It was called Compulsory Figures, and it featured various principal literary features through time. And actually, did you forget you wrote that? Because you haven't mentioned it for a while. You remember you wrote that?
Yeah.
Because I asked him tonight, I said, oh yeah, that's right, right. But I want to just tell you one more very brief thing about the kind of guy he is. He was on my radio program a couple of times, and in 1983, it's kind of a very, a radio station that would put on poetry, as you can imagine, is not exactly the top state-of-the-art kind of technical radio program. So we were on air, and we had a failure in the technical. And every time someone rang the front door buzzer, it came through on the air. And so here I am trying to...
There's a phone on the desk.
Yeah, there was a phone and had all these things. And somehow I was pushing... I wasn't the engineer, but somehow the things got switched. So Henry and I are trying to have this idea about poetry and talk, and I'm presenting him and listening and getting into his space, you know. And bzz, bzz, I'm at the door. Hey, Henry. Hey, Bob, let me in. You got a cigarette? And so this kept coming up and coming up. So finally, I was getting more and more embarrassed and not knowing, very flustered. And so Henry Taylor started taking the calls. As they came in over the radio, he just simply responded to the callers and then went on with the radio. And we braided it in so that it was like live street theater with Henry talking to the people at the front door and reading poetry. It was one of the best programs I've ever had. And so that is the kind of person you can expect to hear tonight. So it is with a great deal of love and admiration I present Henry Taylor.
Thanks, Grace. Well, as Grace mentioned, my most recent book is called Understanding Fiction. I hope it will be widely miscategorized, but it is, in fact, a book of poems. And by way of explaining how such a thing could happen, I'll read the title poem, which is called Understanding Fiction. What brings it to mind this time? The decal from East Stroudsburg State in the window ahead of me as traffic winds to the airport. Maybe we pass the Stroudwater Landing apartments. Whatever it is, you who are with me get to hear it all over again. How once, just out of college, or maybe a year or two later, into the first teaching job, some circumstance found me in the home of an old friend, one of the mentors to whom I owe what I am, on one of those days when the airwaves are filled with football. We remember it now as four games and swear to one another and to others that this is what happened. In the second game, as men unpiled from a crowded scramble, a calm voice remarked that Mike Stroud had been in on the tackle, and we told ourselves that we had heard the same thing in the first game. Odd. So we listened, or claimed to be listening, and drank and took what we were pleased to call notice. Never an isolating or identifying shot, just these brief observations of crowds. Mike Stroud was in all four games. An astonishing trick, a terrific story, some plot of the color commentators, a tribute to a friend with a birthday, or maybe just a joke on the world. I tell it at least four times a year, and each time it is longer ago. Mike Stroud, if he ever played football, does not do so now. But he might even have played only one game that late fall day in, 1967, let's say. We were drinking. God knows what we heard. But I tell it again and see how to help you believe it. So I make some adjustment of voice or detail, and the story strides into the future. Just about the, come on in, it's all right. We're not going to make, we're going to make, we'll make a little fun of you, but. The first poet to really speak to me when I was a late teenager, the first really serious poet, the grown-up poet to matter to me, was Edwin Arlington Robinson. He's not much read now, but maybe, in my opinion, he maybe should be again. Anyway, in my first book, 30 years ago, there's a long poem that owes something to him, and it takes its epigraph from one of his early great poems, The Man Against the Sky. The lines that I used as an epigraph are, "For whether lighted over ways that save, or lured from all repose, if he go on too far to find a grave, mostly alone he goes." Recently, circumstances have gotten me to the state of Maine fairly often. My wife lives there all the time, so I live there when I can. And the grave of E.A. Robinson is there, and I finally made a kind of pilgrimage. So this is at the grave of E.A. Robinson. Decades of vague intention drifted by before I brought small thanks for your large voice. A bunch of hothouse blooms and Queen Anne's lace and four lines from The Man Against the Sky. My poems, whatever they do, will not repay the debt they owe to yours. So I let pass a swift half hour watching the wind distress the fringes of my fragile, doomed bouquet. I beg your pardon, sir. You've understood what use there is in standing here like this, speaking to one who hears as well as stone. Yet, though no answer comes, it does me good to sound aloud above your resting place hard accents I will carry to my own. Another poet of the same period is treated less seriously in this next poem, called Within a Stone's Throw of Greatness. You need to recall that Wallace Stevens was for many years a vice president of the Hartford Insurance Company. He was an insurance executive and an apparently a very good one. Within a Stone's Throw of Greatness. Oh, he died in 1955 also, for those of there's a little bit of arithmetic in the poem. It's pretty quick, but. Among the guests I talked to once at a wedding in the late 60s, back when the principals at such affairs are my own friends, not my children's, there was the father of the groom, who turned out to be a vice president with the Hartford Insurance Company. It had been almost 13 years since the death of Wallace Stevens, but I put the question anyway. Yeah, I knew Wally. I even know why you're asking. I'm aware that he wrote poetry. I never read any of it, but I'll tell you this, he was a hell of an underwriter. Two horse poems, one of them not serious, one of them much more so. The first one is called Riding Lesson. I learned two things from an early riding teacher. He held a nervous filly in one hand and gestured with the other, saying, "Listen, keep one leg on one side, the other leg on the other side, and your mind in the middle." He turned and mounted. She took two steps, then left the ground, I thought for good, but she came down hard, humped her back, swallowed her neck, and threw her rider as you'd throw a rock. He rose, brushed his pants, and caught his breath, and said, "See, that's the way to do it. When you see they're gonna throw you, get off." And this one, a little more solemnity here, this one is called Riding a One-Eyed Horse. And it started out as, I knew that it was about something, and I'm not sure exactly what it's about, but I figured the only way to get anywhere close to that was to just tell the truth about what I know about how to do that. If you ever should find yourself trying to ride a one-eyed horse, here's what you need to know. One side of his world is always missing. You may give it a casual wave of the hand or rub it with your shoulder as you pass, but nothing on his blind side ever happens. Hundreds of trees slip past him into darkness, drifting into a hollow hemisphere whose sounds you will have to try to explain. Your legs will tell him not to be afraid if you learn never to lie. Do not forget to turn his head and let what comes come seen. He will jump the fences he has to if you swing toward them from the side that he can see, and hold his good eye straight. The heavy dark will stay beside you always. Let him learn to lean against it. It will steady him and see you safely through diminished fields. And I think maybe this is the last of the horse poems, but I'll read the title poem of my third book, The Flying Change. It's in two parts, as you see before you, those of you who've picked up the handout. It's the first part is a prose paragraph, and the second part is in rhymed and metered stanzas, slant rhymed and metered stanzas. When a horse gallops or canters, there comes a moment when all 4 feet are off the ground. When they come back down again, the first one to hit is one of the hind legs, then the other hind leg and the opposite foreleg, and then finally the far foreleg. And that is the leading foreleg. Horses like to go around curves with the leading foreleg on the inside of the curve. It balances them better that way. They do this naturally. They're born knowing how to change leads in mid-stride. While all 4 feet are off the ground, they can change their minds about what lead they're on and come down on the lead that they were not on. Teaching them to do this when you want them to do it is a matter for a lot of patience, not to mention skill, the flying change. The canter has 2 stride patterns, one on the right lead and one on the left, each a mirror image of the other. The leading foreleg is the last to touch the ground before the moment of suspension in the air. On cantered curves, the horse tends to lead with the inside leg. Turning at liberty, he can change leads without effort during the moment of suspension. But a rider's weight makes this more difficult. The aim of teaching a horse to move beneath you is to remind him how he moved when he was free. 2. A single leaf turns sideways in the wind in time to save a remnant of the day. I am lifted like a whip crack to the moves I studied on that barbered stretch of ground before I schooled myself to drift away from skills I still possess but must outlive. Sometimes, when I cup water in my hands and watch it slip away and disappear, I see that age will make my hands a sieve. But for a moment, the shifting world suspends its flight and leans toward the sun once more, as if to interrupt its mindless plunge through works and days that will not come again. I hold myself immobile in bright air, sustained in time astride the flying change. I will explain that my wife and I were married in 1965, divorced in 1967, and married in 1995. We had a 27-year divorce, which eventually we decided had been a failure. We gave it our best shot, I think. So, underpass. We were walking at dusk through the neighborhood where we had fallen in love. Just past the theater, under the railroad bridge, we paused to watch a camper-topped pickup negotiate the dangerous clearance there. A passenger, a woman of maybe 20, in close-fitting jeans and the long hair of those days, danced down from the running board into the street and stood where she could watch the critical diminishing space. She waved the driver on, and as the cab drew abreast of where we were, we saw another young woman crouched over the wheel, peering first at the underside of the bridge, then at her friend or sister, and inching slowly forward. They were young and beautiful, we thought. And so, to tell the truth, were we. This was probably 1964. We held our breath as they made it through. The passenger floated back into her seat, and the camper's taillights melted into the traffic. For all we knew, they were taking it a few blocks, but something told us they had far to go. We loaded some dreams of our own into that truck and gripped each other's arms as it pulled away. Today, using the phone to do some serious work on the miles between us, we thought of them and wondered where they had gone, with what cargo. Like us, they're pushing 50 or have passed it, and may, like us, have children on one road or another. If we could tell them anything, we would try to thank them for having carried some fragile promises of ours to a place where, as things have turned out, they could be kept. Those decades back, my love, we wished them well. And if that wish had any force at all, they came in off the road some time ago and may even be as beautiful as you. And the dedication poem for the book is, it's called A Grace, not The Grace. I take it to mean both a blessing and a gracefulness. There's a reference in the poem to a preparation called bœuf carbonade. Literally, that is charred beef. It's better than it sounds. A grace. I give thanks for the way our kitchen dance takes on the familiarity of ritual. From the moment of decision, reached in a mixture of eagerness and relief, you'll roast a chicken, maybe, or walk us both toward bœuf carbonade. Through the several subtasks we can or cannot help each other do, and we quiet down hearing small sounds of lettuce being torn, prunes snipped in quarters, the nearly silent bristles of the mushroom brush. And then the table set and served, the centering on a moment of hope and gratitude, as once again we face each other, having done a small and daily kind of work in a large, eternal kind of joy. Arising from the fact that I have two sons, the first of these goes back to the flying change, is called Green Springs the Tree. The title is a phrase that comes out of a sonnet by Sir Walter Raleigh, which is usually anthologized as Sir Walter Raleigh to his son. Who knows what he called it? Maybe nothing. The premise of Raleigh's poem is that there are three things that flourish and do fine and grow up and are healthy as long as you keep them separate. They are trees, out of which on a really bad day you can make a gallows. The weed, as he says, or hemp, which on a really bad day you can string the gallows with. And wags, or naughty little boys, who on really, really bad days might have an encounter with the other two. Mark well, dear boy, he says, whilst these assemble not, green springs the tree, hemp grows, the wag is wild. But when they meet, it makes the timber rot, it frets the halter, and it chokes the child. Then bless thee, and beware, and let us pray we part not with thee at this meeting day. Pretty hard-nosed poem, I'd say, for greeting your son, but so, green springs the tree. My young son lurches halfway down the stair, or shrieks and totters midway through a climb from the wobbling bookcase to the rocking chair. I freeze and hold my breath. Most of the time I am too far away to break the fall that seldom comes. Instead, I stoop and bend with him as if threads of remote control could reach out and could reel out and connect him to my hand that strains against his fall, against my leap to rescue him. My twisting body prays for skill in this, the high wire he will keep both of us on as we rehearse the ways to braid these strands of our inheritance and teach poor body English how to dance. Popped Balloon. I can honestly say that this poem was written over a period of about 18 years because I wrote the first 3/4 of it right after the episode described in it happened. And I looked at it and I said, well, yeah, that's what happened, all right. So what? And it took the main character had to do a lot of stuff before I figured that out. Popped Balloon. For 2 days, off and on, the little boy inflated a balloon and let it go, whooping as it careened with a Bronx cheer to a corner of the room, where, after a while, he let it lie for another day or so, then found it, tried to blow it up, and stood dead still when it exploded in his face. He wept and banged his forehead with his hand while I told him how balloons get old and tired from all that getting fat and going thin. No use explaining. He wanted to have it back. There are others, I said. No, that one. More tears. At last, he huffed a desperate breath at it. The air flapped loosely through the ragged end and made a splattered moan like a ripped kazoo, a ghastly, joyful noise that set him off through the house again, amazed at what he'd found. I cheered him on. How could I keep from thinking of other things that weaken until they break and limp through the world, making their healing groans? A few more breaths, and 2 decades are gone. Now, here is this young man, becoming more himself with every blessing, every wound. Like any doting father, I have prayed, but he already bears his share of scars and finds, in answer to my selfish hopes, fresh uses for what's left of broken toys, a keener ear for the joy in crippled songs. And I'll end up with a poem addressed to that gentleman's younger brother, who is mentioned by name along about the third stanza, Richard, who's now almost 21, but who went through a period of difficulty during which among other things, it was necessary to remember that there are forms of depression that respond very poorly indeed to advice that you ought to cheer up. Afternoons with a boomerang. An insect afternoon of annoyance, discontent, the vain wish to be far away, and I sit on the patio staring at lawn, woods, receding green patches with the impossible loveliness of vanished children's books. Yet here it is around me, consoling if not healing. I know no kinder place in which to bear involuntary gloom. Then, across the patio comes a blur, red shorts, legs, arms, three strides to grass, and I can focus now on Richard coming out from under the weight of his own troubles, his hand cocked, gripping a bright handmade boomerang that now he throws like a knife at a target. For 60 instantaneous feet it flies straight, then yanks left and banks upward, tilting into level flight, a spun, evanescent circle back to the house, then toward another sweep by the woods, flickering in and out of view against backgrounds of sycamore and maple, sky and grass, a flutter of silence to where he pirouettes, watching the cycle close as the end of the spiral drops within reach and he plucks it from air. Our separate woes may not pass for more than a moment, but this is the moment. Not that he never misses. The stick will spin too hard to be caught, or a stray current of air from the woods grabs an edge, or he has to look into the sun. Sometimes the gravel driveway breaks his stride over the dampening grass. 20 minutes, half an hour, and his arm tires. Still, it always feels like forever. Infinite small variations within the aboriginal pattern. And I think that whatever their use among hunters, artists most deeply own these physical mysteries of getting a skill right, or nearly so, or rarely, of getting it wrong. The shout going up at the botched release. The sharp smile of disgust as the boomerang goes off course and snags itself in a tree. Error and correction, flight and return, my son pulling hard as he can toward making a life that is his, lifting himself a little from his private griefs, and me for a while out of mine. And though the pain returns, he gives in fading light a look of birthright ease to a difficult thing. Whatever unrolls on this spiral path, lifelong though it may be and hard, is worth no more in the end than these crystal instants of grace and lighthearted awe. Thank you.
You have been listening to The Poet and the Poem, from the Library of Congress, featuring Rita Dove and Henry Taylor from Berlin. The series is produced by Forest Woods Media. Post-production is by Mike Turpin of MET Studios. We wish to thank the Motion Picture Broadcasting and Recorded Sound Division of the Library of Congress. The series is brought to you by the Witter Binner Foundation for Poetry. Our engineer is Ken Flynn. I'm Grace Cavalieri.